Sometimes a single experience does indeed change the course of an entire life. It did for a young man called Lanier Phillips.
Phillips grew up in the Deep South before the Second World War. He's black, and to escape the hardships of Jim Crow, he joined the Navy. In 1942, his ship, the USS Truxton, was in a convoy off the south coast of Newfoundland. It was caught in a vicious storm. The Truxton and another ship, the Pollux, both ran aground. 203 sailors died, one of the worst tragedies in U.S. naval history. But Phillips survived. Producer Chris Brooks has the story of a man and the shipwreck that changed his life forever.
You turn left up here by the stop sign.
Okay.
It's very, you see the high school's down there.
St. Lawrence, Newfoundland, Canada. Population 1,697 souls. Before the mine closed, they were miners and fishermen. A five-hour drive from the city, perched at the tip of a rocky peninsula, jutting into the North Atlantic.
Now just keep on going.
The person giving me directions here is Ina Edwards. She's kind of the unofficial St. Lawrence historian.
Getting close to it, though.
Where Ina's taking me here is to the new school playground, but it's going to take us about 20 minutes to get there, because on the way, I want to tell you the rest of this story. We'll come back to this car at the end when we get to the playground, but the beginning of this story is 3,000 miles south of here, all the way down in DeKalb County, Georgia.
If you'll step in here, I'll show you what I have in here. That I'll always keep. Down at this end, at the very beginning here, that's St. Lawrence.
That photograph.
Yeah, that's St. Lawrence. And this is here's my grandmother, great-grandmother and grandfather, who were born slaves. I don't know exactly when he was born, but I know she was born in 1852. Well, I'm Lanier Phillips. I was born March 14th, 1923. And I live in DeKalb County. And DeKalb County didn't finish schools for black people until 1939. They didn't want the blacks to have any kind of education. But I was going to a school they call Yellow River. Black people got together and built this school. But the Ku Klux Klan burned the school down, you know. Yes, sir, they burned. I remember that clear. I can close my eyes and see the flames going, standing and watching the school burn. And I saw no future. I had no dreams, because only thing I could say, well, maybe I'll be a sharecropper or something, you know, once I grew up. So I said, I think I'll join the Navy. So in 41, I joined the Navy. I went aboard ship. My first ship was the Truxton. Well, they had blacks in one place and whites in another. And the blacks on board ship, they could only be mess attendants, serving and taking what they call taking care of your officers. On board ship, the blacks had nowhere to sit to eat. They had to stand and eat. The whites sat. The officers had a tablecloth and, you know, china and all, and we would serve them. They would sit there and eat, but all the blacks had to stand in this little pantry and eat. The home port was Boston. Once we left Boston, we slept what we call ready roll. We didn't pull our clothing off because we knew that the submarines were there.
And at the time of the disaster, in 1942, February the 18th, in St. Lawrence, it was Ash Wednesday, and a ferocious storm, real blizzard.
I'm Gus Echegaray. I was about 16 and a half in 1942, a young fellow just finished high school in St. Lawrence. It was a hell of a storm. There's no doubt about it at all. I don't know what the estimate of the winds would be, but it had the full strife of the Atlantic.
And I guess many people said, maybe it was even said in our house, What a dreadful night. We pitted poor sailors on the sea tonight.
Truxton had no radar. So what they did was relying on dead reckoning.
Before they knew it, they were right into the cliff. Bang.
I thought we had been torpedoed. I didn't know what. I was in my bed. When it hit, down I came. I had all my clothes on. I had my life jacket. And I grabbed a pair of shoes. I didn't know if it was mine or what. And went topside. Well, it was dark. And it was storming. I mean, it was picking the Truxton up and looked like just slamming it against the rock. And you could hear the steel grinding. Then when day began to break, they finally turned on the big searchlight, and all you could see was the cliffs and the rocks. It was like between two rocks, like. And it just picked the ship up, and down it would go. And Wash began to wash the fellows overboard. I almost got washed over two or three times, but I'd grab their lifeline and hold on.
At about 7:30 in the morning, my father called and in a somewhat frantic voice said, get down here as quickly as you can, get a hold of the driver of that pickup truck, load up all the ropes and lines that you could find in the area, and get down to Chambers Cove.
The ship had begun to take on so much water, we knew it was, you know, going to sink. They had said that no man could live in the water more than 5 minutes because of the cold.
As we came up over the hill and looked down, you know, here 300 feet or so below, right in the middle of a sort of a horseshoe cove, this destroyer, this Truxton, partly submerged, but the full length of the rail was still above water. All these people hanging on, if you like, to dear life on the rail. Some were just swept up on those jagged cliffs and then you tumble down and so on. It was a pretty dreadful sight.
About this time, she began to break and all the oil had come out. Oil was coming out. And everybody looked like little rats in the water covered with that crude oil.
I, along with others, went down hand over hand on a rope.
I told the other blacks that were standing there with me, I said, well, you know, we're going to die. I said, if we stay on board this ship, I said, at least we can die fighting. I said, let's go. When I jumped in there, it was like I felt just one quick pain, like that went over my entire body, and it was all over. I didn't feel any pain after that. I just felt sleepy.
And the heavy bunker sea oil was beginning to come into the shoreline, and the water, salt water, would rise and then recede. And as it receded, you'd see this black hulk, you know, digging in, clutching onto the rocks and waiting for somebody to run and try and grab them and try to save them.
And when we got ashore, I said, well, I made it here. I might as well die, you know. So I just laid down there on the beach, and I closed my eyes to die, you know. This is the end. And this fellow came, and he said, get him up. Don't let him lie there. Say, pick him up. Say, he'll surely die if he lays there. I say, walk him around. So he pulled me up. And he had on a cap and a coat. I knew he wasn't Navy. And he began to walk me around. And from there, it brought life to me. I said, man, here's a white person who wants me to live. And, you know, if I had been in Georgia, they'd say, kick him out of the way, you know. Let's help these white people. Then I think I passed out.
They took them to the where there was a temporary first aid station erected. And, of course, the call came to the women. All the women of the place to go out to clean them. And that's where the story came in at Len Eyre. Now, the little funny story. See, he was there among all the other survivors. The ladies were cleaning them up and scrubbing them up because they were covered with tar, with this old stuff, this crude oil. They were so filthy. They had to be, every part of them had to be washed. So when he opened his eyes,
I could see these white ladies all around there I was, stark naked on this table. And I heard one of the ladies say, "This is the curliest hair I've ever seen." I said, "Oh, boy, this is the end of me, you know." I said, "Hell, they're going to say, get him out of here. He's black, you know." And then she said,
"This poor fellow, the tar went right into his pores. I'm scrubbing and scrubbing, and I can't get him clean."
You know, and I spoke up. She said, "Can't get it." I said, "Well, you can't get it off. It's the color of the skin."
And she said, "Oh, I'll get it off all right." And so she continued to scrub. Violet Pike, but she's dead now. She had never seen a black man before. So, I mean, she didn't differentiate. She just thought he was a white man with the black into his pores so bad she couldn't get it out.
And I was thinking, oh, boy, are they going to lynch me? Here I am. If I had been in Georgia, they would have ran those white women out of town and maybe lynched me for letting them bathe me, you know?
And, of course, when the men were taking him out to the different homes, she said, "Bring him to my home." So that evening, then, she prepared supper. And he was amazed that he ate with the family. And he drank out of china cups, the same as the family.
And they put me in the bed. And this lady, she would come in and say, "Are you warm? Are you all right?" And she did this the remainder of the night. I didn't go to sleep anymore because I was still afraid. I didn't know where I was, what was going to happen to me. But then I kept asking myself, did I die and, you know, and I went to heaven? What's going on? So they gave me leave. I think I got 15 days leave. And I went to see my aunt who lived in Chattanooga. And we would catch the bus from there to go into town. And the blacks had to sit behind the whites. When we got on, my aunt and I, the back seat was filled. And here was this white guy. So we sat in the seat in front of him. He reached and grabbed me by the neck and pushed me up and said, "Nigga, don't you sit in front of me." And I was going to fight him. I felt like fighting him then because of the treatment that I'd got in St. Lawrence and what the people have treated me like a human being. I said, "Well, hell, I'm a human. I'm no longer a slave in the lowest and the least, the last." I said, "I'm going to do it." I said, "If I can give my life and fight this war the same as everybody else and can't even ride a bus when I pay the same fare as everybody else, but I can't be seated as everyone else." My mother, my aunt said, "Just be quiet, just be quiet." Said, "We'll be in a few minutes." So I thought about that. They sent me to Jacksonville, Florida. And when I got to Jacksonville, I was hungry. And when I got off and walked into the station, I saw all these prisoners, Italian and German prisoners, and they had Army MPs, Americans. Got them. They had them inside the dining room eating. And I knew that the blacks could go to a window or something somewhere, but I knew they wouldn't be allowed to go into that dining room. And I thought about the people of St. Lawrence, how they had fed me, gave me clothing and put me in their bed. And I looked at the prisoners, and here I am in American uniform. So I went in to ask, you know, where does the colored, is what they call us then, where can the colored Negroes, you know, get something to eat? I'm trying to make it to the Naval Air Station. So I went to go in, and this one cop grabbed me by the collar and slung me on the ground. And when he slung me on the ground, he put his foot right on my neck and actually pulled his gun out and pulled a hammer back. I could hear it click. I thought he was going to shoot me. He said, "You black son of a bitch, I'll blow your black brains out." He said, you know better than to come in here where these white people are. So the white people were the German prisoners in the Italian prison. And here I am in an American uniform. I thought about the people of St. Lawrence. I was tired of shining shoes. I was tired of washing dishes and pots and pans. I was tired of it. I had 17 years in the Navy then as a mess attendant. And I was looking when I get out. I wanted to learn a trade. And I wrote the first black congressman. And I wrote the Bureau of Naval Personnel a letter and told them I thought I was qualified to be something other than a mess attendant. And I did get a chance to go to sonar school by pushing and fighting for it. Blacks weren't supposed to go to sonar school. And when I got that letter back saying report to Fleet Sonar School, I really gave the credit to St. Lawrence. Because had it not been for St. Lawrence, I wouldn't have been writing, you know, the powers to be. Because I had been brainwashed. And I was so inferior to the white man to don't look forward, you know, to ever being anything. But the people in St. Lawrence showed me that, you know, I was a human being the same as all other human beings. I got orders to report to Fleet Sonar School. They called me down. Counselor wants to see you. And I went in to see the counselor. Phillips said, we got good news. I said, oh, I'm going to start class. He said, no, we've contacted Washington, and they go along with it and make you chief steward, mess attendant. He said, because we don't think you can make it through sonar school. I said, well, sir, you can take the first class if you want. I said, but just don't throw me out. He said, well, you know you're going to flunk out, don't you? I said, no, I don't know that. I said, give me a chance. If I flunk out, so be it. He said, all right, you start the next class. So I started the next class, and I went through sonar school. And when I went aboard the ship, the Bailey, I walked up. I saluted the flag and saluted the OD, the officer of the deck. And he told the messenger, who's always there, say, show him where the mess attendant's compartment. I said, no, sir. I said, I'm sonar tech. He said, you what? I said, I'm sonar tech.
The screams of gassed, beaten, and trampled Negro civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama were heard around the world last Sunday.
The next day, I said, I'm going to Selma.
The possibility of further violence seemed certain.
I wanted to be a part of that because I knew that the way I was changed from accepting the inhumane treatment that was given to me, it was worth fighting to be a human being. And that's why I went to Selma. And every way you look down the barrel of a gun at the time.
It'll be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that you have to turn around and disperse.
I have no hatred for the Ku Klux Klan or any human being. I pray for these people, these racists and bigots, that something might happen to them, not go through the icy waters of the North Atlantic, but something will happen to make them change, as happened to me, and make them change and look at all people as God's children.
You cannot go any place. You cannot march any place. You cannot.
There's the board right there. Look.
By now, you've probably forgotten how we started this story. Driving around St. Lawrence, 59 years after the shipwreck, with the town historian, Ina Edwards, looking for the brand new school playground.
See, there's the playground, established by the students at Marion Elementary School in 1999. You can go almost into it, you can go in.
I'm not a rich man, but every contribution I can make, I make it to the people of St. Lawrence. I realized since the mine closed, the economy is way down.
He has shown gratitude, no doubt about it, you know. And they're trying to get a new playground for the elementary school. And that's about, I have a nice check to present from Lanier.
I've said, do whatever the society wants to do with this. I say, but I would like for you to, you know, do something for your museum and let the world know what you did for the entire crew of the Truxton. And here's this black man. Let them know what you did for him, too, and how you changed him.
Della, Lanier Phillips, USS Truxton survivor. And then on the other side is the USS Truxton, lost February 18, 1942. And the Marion Elementary School logo is in the center. And the name of the playground is Lanier Phillips Playground.
I just want the people of St. Lawrence to know how much I appreciate them. And I want them to know what they did for me. They put into my mind, it's etched in there, it's solid, like liquid steel. Hot steel became cold and solid. It's into me, and it'll never leave me.
The story of Lanier Phillips was written and produced by Chris Brooks. Lanier Phillips himself is long retired from the Navy. He lives in the U.S. Navy home in Gulfport, Mississippi.